I'm Fiona Wirch with the news from the BBC World Service. There's muted international response to the announcement by the new military leader of Pakistan that he intends to return the country to democracy. General Pervez Musharraf did not give a date. He said the army had taken over because Pakistan had been brought to its knees and its economy was in ruins. The aim was to end corruption and revive the economy. He said the armed forces would stay in power no longer than necessary. A meeting of Commonwealth foreign ministers today is expected to recommend Pakistan's suspension from the organisation. Brigadier Rashid Qureshi is the military spokesman in Pakistan, and he explained why the general had been unable to give a date for the return to democracy.
He has outlined what he feels must be done for true democracy to be restored. The past year's disregard for not only human rights but for all democratic processes had reduced Pakistan to just a democracy in name and not in substance at all. It's very difficult to make an estimate, and one can only make an estimate after taking into consideration all that needs to be done.
Brigadier Rashid Qureshi. Indonesian negotiators are in East Timor for talks about how to hand over power. The delegation is meeting members of the International Peacekeeping Force and United Nations representatives. Key issues include Indonesian demands to recover or dispose of its assets in East Timor, ranging from state telecommunications to individual private properties. A spokesman for the UN mission in the territory, Andrew Ladley, says the discussions are being conducted in a good atmosphere.
They've arrived to say that they're assisting with the transition. They expect to be here until the end of it, which they think won't be very long, as a matter of interest. There's a substantial task force of some 34 people. In particular, from our side, we are seeking their immediate assistance with the return of the refugees and access to Akusi. From their side, there's a number of matters that are on the agenda, including preparing for the possible arrival of their commission of inquiry from the Indonesian Human Rights Commission.
Andrew Ladley. Russian troops are reported to have entered the outskirts of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. The new offensive came just hours after the Russian Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin, said he would not launch a full-scale ground attack on the city. Russian forces had regrouped along the key Terek River, which separates the Russian-controlled northern third of Chechnya from the rest of the republic. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is due to arrive in Sierra Leone about now at the start of a six-day tour of Africa intended to promote democracy and highlight threats to stability on the continent. She's expected to express her concern over the slow implementation of July's peace agreement, which ended 9 years of civil war in the country. U.S. human rights groups have called on Mrs. Albright to give her backing to a South African-style truth commission. You're listening to the BBC News. A judge in Malaysia says there's enough evidence against the former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim for his trial to continue. Mr. Anwar is accused of sodomising the family driver. If he's found guilty, he faces a maximum sentence of 20 years and a mandatory whipping. In his first trial, Mr. Anwar was sentenced to 6 years in jail earlier this year when a court found him guilty of misuse of power. Francis Harrison reports.
Judge Arifin Jaka said the prosecution had made their case against Anwar Ibrahim beyond reasonable doubt, and he ordered the defense to prepare their witnesses. It's likely Mr. Anwar will be the first witness called, though his lawyers say they'll call for an adjournment to prepare their case. Judge lawyers argued for nearly an hour that they should be told the reasons why the judge had decided not to acquit Mr. Anwar at this halfway point in the trial. But the judge said he was not obliged to give reasons why he thought there was a case for them to answer.
Francis Harrison. In what's being seen as a pointer to next year's Spanish national elections, the main opposition Socialist Party has done better than expected in regional elections in Catalonia. It lost on the number of seats, 56 to 52, but won the biggest share of the poll in voting for a new assembly. The regional government will be led, as for the last 19 years, by the Catalan nationalist Jordi Pujol. Islamic militants have vowed to avenge the execution in Yemen on Sunday of the leader of a militant Islamic group who was convicted of kidnapping and killing Western hostages last year. The radical cleric Abu Hamza al-Masri, who lives in Britain, said that his death would not go to waste. The Islamic group seized 16 Western tourists last December. Four, three Britons and an Australian, were killed in a firefight between Yemeni troops and the kidnappers. Three of the kidnappers were also killed in the rescue attempt. The Islamic group had threatened to attack Western targets in Yemen. With the time at 6 minutes past the hour, that's the BBC News.
conflicting reports that Russian forces have entered the outskirts of the Chechen capital, Grozny, continuing their ongoing offensive against Islamic militants they blame for recent attacks inside Russia. The BBC's Jonathan Charles joins us now live from Moscow. Jonathan, what are Russian officials saying?
Well, we're getting these reports, although there's no independent confirmation, that the Russian troops are some 15 kilometers, that's about 9 or 10 miles, from Grozny on the far outskirts. And we think at the moment that may be as far as they'll go. The Russian Prime Minister has been making it clear for the past 24 hours that there's no question of Russian forces entering the Chechen capital itself.
Jonathan, how important is Grozny as a military objective? Don't most of the militants operate from the mountains outside the city?
Certainly some of the militants are inside Grozny, and obviously the Chechen president at the moment is thought to be there, Aslan Maskhadov. So there are good reasons for trying to subdue Grozny. But I suppose there's more than one way to skin a cat. One thing that the Russian forces might decide to do is just to encircle Grozny, to try to cut it off, cut off all its supplies, cut off its road connections with any other part of Chechnya, and that way perhaps force the surrender of the city. What they don't want to do is to have to go into the Chechen capital itself. They remember full well that in the last war in the mid-1990s, they suffered very heavy military losses in the Chechen capital because the Chechen rebels proved very good at street fighting.
Jonathan, thanks very much. The BBC's Jonathan Charles in Moscow. It's 8 minutes past the hour. You're listening to World Update from the BBC in London. I'm Vicky Barker. In 2 days, Indonesia's National Assembly will choose a new president. For those outside the country, attention has been focused, of course, on the chaos and tragedy which followed the independence referendum in East Timor. But for most Indonesians, East Timor has been a peripheral issue. The battered state of Indonesia's economy has been the big campaign issue, in particular, a corruption scandal involving a local bank. Jonty Bloom of our economic staff reports.
War is always more exciting than finance, but it isn't always the most important issue. As the international community struggles to restore peace and order to East Timor, Indonesia has been electing a new president. But it isn't the loss of East Timor that's been dominating the election, but the corruption surrounding the Habibie government. Indonesians, Bali evokes thoughts of a tropical paradise. In Indonesia, it means the Bank Bali scandal, and this is how it worked. Following the economic collapse in the Far East in 1997, many Indonesian banks went bust, but not Bank Bali. However, it was owed around $100 million by banks which had gone under. Fortunately, it was insured against such bad debts by the Indonesian government, which therefore owed Bank Bali $100 million. The trouble was, no matter how hard it tried, it couldn't get the government to pay up. Then a business approached Bank Bali and offered to help it recover the money. For a small charge, of course. That small charge turned out to be 70% of the money it was owed, and the business turned out to be run by a businessman linked to President Habibie. In effect, Bank Bali paid a $70 million bribe to the ruling party to get back less than one-third of the money it was legally entitled to from the government. And as Professor Anne Booth of the School of Oriental and African Studies in London explains, it gets worse.
In fact, an independent audit was commissioned from PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they submitted quite a detailed report to the Indonesian audit agency. But this report has not been made public. In fact, I understand it hasn't even been given to the IMF or the World Bank. And the reason, clearly, is that a number of senior officials were named, and this was highly embarrassing.
Not only that, but it's pretty certain that the government body set up to reform the banking sector and remove corruption was actually involved in the scam. The result has been rioting on the streets of Jakarta. Indonesia is now the only country in the Far East still in recession, and according to Carl Ziegler of the Center for Accountability and Debt Relief, the reason isn't hard to find.
Ruling elites who are self-serving could probably take as much as 30 to sometimes 50% of the public purse into their own personal use. And when you have corruption percentages from the public purse of more than 20%, by definition you have an economy in decline. There's no way to grow with you basically cream that amount of public expenditure off the top.
And as a result, the International Monetary Fund and World Bank have frozen loans to Indonesia that the country desperately needs and demanded that it gets its house in order. Professor Booth, again.
Earlier in the year, there were some signs that the economy might be recovering. But as a result of the Bank Bali scandal, I think confidence has been further damaged. And as a result, I think, there's very little hope now for any sustained recovery until a new government comes to power.
And it isn't only Indonesians that are sick of corruption. Just last week, the president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, warned that the rich Western countries were getting fed up with giving aid to corrupt regimes that ended up in offshore bank accounts. In the past, despite massive corruption and the occupation East Timor, the West has pulled back from allowing Indonesia's economy to totally collapse. But patience is obviously running out, both at home and abroad.
The BBC's Jonty Bloom reporting, and we'll have an update from East Timor later in the program. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is in Sierra Leone this morning, the second stop of an African tour. By just about any marker you can think of, Sierra Leone is one of the most wretched places on Earth. It's only just emerged from a war which human rights groups charge featured some of the most barbaric atrocities on Earth. And Sierra Leone's government has just done a deal sharing power with the same rebels accused of deliberately killing, raping, and mutilating civilians. The United States supported that deal, and now human rights groups are telling Mrs. Albright that the story of Sierra Leone must not end there. The BBC's West Africa correspondent Mark Doyle joins us now live. Mark, what do human rights groups want Mrs. Albright to do?
I think that what they would like her to do is to press for some sort of South African-style truth and reconciliation commission in Sierra Leone, so that even if this rather controversial peace deal whereby the rebels who committed the atrocities have been accommodated does go forward, that nevertheless the atrocities will at least be in the public domain and part of public record. The reason for this being important, of course, is that if people are seen to be allowed to get away with committing these kind of appalling atrocities that happened during the war in Sierra Leone, then other groups will see committing atrocities as a way of gaining a share of power and thereby institute a circle of impunity, if you like.
Does Sierra Leone have the kind of civil structure which would support that kind of commission?
It certainly does. In the capital, Freetown, there are large numbers of educated people. There are very lively civic groups, lively local human rights groups, as well as the representatives of international human rights groups who've made this particular call to Mrs. Albright. And so there is the structures there. There is the information. It is possible to record what happened in Sierra Leone. It's just that it requires a lot of input from the international community, because as you mentioned in your introduction there, Sierra Leone is very probably the poorest country in the world.
Mark, President Clinton has been pushing for African solutions to African problems. Wasn't this power-sharing deal an African solution?
Yes, it was an African solution, but the African countries which were party to it, in particular Nigeria, don't really have the resources to follow through. And although President Clinton, of course, has called for African solutions and that ultimately would be a good thing, there is, of course, a yawning chasm between the other areas of the world where the Americans do act. I mean, one can think of Kuwait, Kosovo, etc. Those countries aren't told to pull up their own bootstraps, and so why should African countries have to? This is what the perception here in Africa, that there is a very big gap and that double standards do apply when it comes to trying to solve African problems.
What are the expectations then for Mrs. Albright's visit?
Well, she'll be talking about democracy, she'll be talking about a reduction in corruption and so on, the sort of things that American diplomats always talk about, and that will of course be welcomed by most Africans, and there are signs in some of the countries that she's visiting, in particular the largest West African state, Nigeria, where democracy is moving forward under a democratically elected president, and I've no doubt that Mrs. Albright will be congratulating Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo for that, but there are other places where things are going backwards, and the Americans will be doing their usual thing of trying to encourage democracy and trying to reduce the amount of corruption in these places. But there is a perception that Africa is not seen as important as some other parts of the world.
Mark, thank you. The BBC's West Africa correspondent, Mark Doyle, speaking to me from Abidjan in the Ivory Coast. Look at what's making headlines around the world. Well, understandably, General Parvez Musharraf, the new military ruler of Pakistan, dominates many papers. Both India's Hindu and the Times of India show a grim, bespectacled General Musharraf pledging yesterday to act against corruption and restore democracy eventually. The Hindustan Times quotes an Indian official calling it premature to comment one way or the other on the possible resumption of talks with Pakistan. Here in Britain, the focus is on what General Musharraf didn't say. He said little about the return of democracy beyond acknowledging that he had violated the democratic order, only to save it, notes the Times of London. The Independent here suggests that General Musharraf is not a man to waste time, noting that a purge of what it calls the old guard is already underway. His term fading, a wistful Clinton loosens up, says the Washington Post this morning. The Post says President Clinton has reached a certain coveted point in his presidency. It is that time at last when he feels free at last to say whatever he likes. There are self-deprecating jokes colored by what some friends believe is a touch of genuine envy about how Vice President Gore and First Lady Hillary Clinton now command the spotlight. This from the Washington Post. And finally, the British Sun tabloid quashes speculation this morning and says Prince Andrew will never remarry his ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, otherwise known as Fergie. And the Sun says it knows why. Members of Britain's royal family can only marry with the Queen's consent. Even though Prince Andrew and Fergie continue to live under the same roof, the Sun says the Queen would never allow her son to remarry the woman who attracted so many scathing headlines. And one royal aide is quoted as saying, Andrew wouldn't consider going against his mother. And we will have more from the world's front pages later in the program. It's coming up to 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Vicky Barker with World Update from the BBC. With the latest headlines from the BBC, here's Fiona Wurge.
A pledge by the new military ruler in Pakistan to return the country to democracy eventually has received a cautious welcome from diplomats. A court in Malaysia has ruled that the sodomy trial against the former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim should continue. And Russian troops are reported to have entered the outskirts of the Chechen capital, Grozny. Vicky.
Thanks, Fiona. You're listening to World Update from the BBC here in London. This is World Update from the BBC World Service.